The Jason Rant Show.
Jason Rant hosts a radio show in Seattle, and he has, as always, the details for us exclusively.
Jason Rant, our Seattle guy, is with us now.
Jason Rant, always great to have you in focus. Thank you.
Hey, Jason, I think you're all right, and thanks for being on the show.
An update on what's happening in your Pacific Northwest.
Unskilled baristas are upset that they're treated like unskilled baristas. We've got Karine Jean-Pierre taking on Ron DeSantis. Guess who's going to win that argument? Plus, Lakewood City Councilmember Don Anderson explains why they finally made the decision to get serious on the open use of drugs. We're going to get into those stories and so much more this hour of The Jason Rant Show. So, let's get into it.
The monologue.
So, a bunch of unskilled baristas for Starbucks decided to protest yesterday about an event that's happening today. They were outside of the headquarters in SoTo, in Seattle. This was a sort of a rally in support or in solidarity with the union members. There are some who have unionized, others have not. You hear a whole bunch of claims from the union folks saying that Starbucks is getting in the way of their unionizing efforts. I believe you're not supposed to do that, but I also turn a blind eye because this is a horrible idea for anyone who's a barista to try to become unionized. So they got together. They did what they normally do, which is just chant. When do we want it? Next week. Contract. Next year. No, now. Oh, no, she got loud. Okay, so it goes on and on and on. Some yesterday spoke with our sister station, Cairo News Radio, and they said, hey, there are some union-busting tactics going on here. We don't like it at all.
We've seen unprecedented union-busting coming from it. We've seen the district manager in our store watching us. We've had two people fired, and that's why we're here protesting.
Now, of course, there couldn't be any reason to fire anyone other than the fact that they're trying to create a union. None whatsoever. They're making an example out of them. Here's a worker who works at one of the stores in downtown Seattle.
I don't think that anybody thought it was going to be an easy fight, but we are definitely putting in the work, and our workers are just focusing on standing together and getting a contract that we know we deserve.
And she claims her name is Sarah. She claims, coming from a unionized workforce for her store, that all of this retaliation is going on.
The things that people started to get written up for, to get fired for, they're things that, you know, a year ago would have never happened. Absolutely, it's retaliation.
Absolutely, it's retaliation. I do like the idea. A year ago, when we didn't do our job, we didn't get written up, but now we're getting written up. So to me, that just, let's just say that that's true. That indicates a year ago they were going easy on you, and now they're just having basic expectations either being met or not, and they respond thusly. Now, despite apparently hating this company to the point where she sees all this retaliation going on, she doesn't want to leave.
It makes me want to fight, and it makes me want to stand up for my workers that are being treated badly and stick together so that we can get everybody their jobs back that deserves them.
Yeah, everyone should get their jobs back. And of course, Starbucks came out and said, look, you can protest all you want, but we put a proposal on the table. You might want to actually respond to that, and then we can go ahead and have that conversation. Now, today, the event that we're talking about is a shareholders meeting, virtual shareholders meeting. And you've got folks who want to continue this public pressure campaign for Starbucks to basically allow the unionized efforts to move forward. And from their perspective, all the baristas unite so that they have some power against Starbucks. And that's precisely why Starbucks wants nothing to do with the unions. They're going to do what they can in a legal way to prevent this from happening, not just because it will hurt the workers, but it'll also hurt the customers and ultimately hurt Starbucks. This is the existential threat to Starbucks. There was a conversation not long ago during COVID about how COVID has changed not just Starbucks, but coffee shops. Where do people still want to go into a coffee shop and have meetings? Do they want to go back to the way it used to be, where you would just hang out there for a bit? And for a long time, the thinking was because people were so, you know, scared of COVID and the future with the COVID, they said, oh, we're going to start seeing less of that, and we're just going to see more of app delivery and maybe drive-through business. But what seems pretty clear to me is that everyone's going back to normal. Everyone's going back to the way that they acted, whether it's with Starbucks or any other company. So Starbucks is a company that has not been doing so well financially because of COVID, and they want to sort of rebound to a strengthened corporation that they once were. They can't do that when we're talking about union workers, because the union workers, as a union, the power dynamic would give them so much more power in that dynamic that they would ask for, demand, and ultimately receive higher pay that they're not worth. A barista, sorry, some of you work really, really hard. There's no doubt about that. But you don't work to the point of demanding $30 an hour. Sorry, you're not worth that. That's how this business is run. On paying baristas a quote-unquote living wage and giving you great benefits, which Starbucks actually offers. But there is a limit. There's going to be a limit. These are not jobs meant for you to hold forever. These are not jobs meant for you to build a family around. These are starter jobs, just like the ones at McDonald's, just like the ones that just do basic retail cashier work or stocking work. That's not meant for you to have it and grow and grow and grow and make six figures. Not every job can do that. Not every job will do it. And at some point, these folks are just going to ask for so much and sometimes win some of those arguments, but in the long run, put them out of business because the Starbucks locations can't afford what it is they're asking for. Now this.
The interview.
The city of Lakewood made a decision to say, no more. We're not going to allow people to openly use drugs in our city. We'd like to get them help, but if they're unwilling to get help, there are going to be some consequences. Joining me on the line is Lakewood City Council member Don Anderson. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
How bad did the situation get for you to effectively be pushed into this position?
Well, I think it's worse in the Puget Sound area than it is in Lakewood. We're doing some of this on a preemptive basis. The problems caused by three factors, the Washington State Supreme Court, the Washington State Legislature, and cheap fentanyl. We're just trying to add some common sense to the equation in our own community.
Now, we're told that this is criminalizing addiction. It's criminalizing the homeless. I imagine you heard some of those claims, maybe not even from people who live in Lakewood, but from activists. What is your response to that?
I think that the opposing voices are enabling rather than empowering people to make their lives better. Sometimes tough love is what is needed. Mm-hmm. In this case, you really misdemeanor drug offenses don't, for all practical purposes, exist anymore. And open smoking of meth and fentanyl as use and injections are on the news every day. People see them in their own communities. So if people want to do that, there will be some consequences. But along the way, we get the opportunity to use the justice system to push them toward treatment and make their lives better, rather than watch them kill themselves on the streets.
Well, and that's really what this is about. I mean, when we say tough love, it still involves love. The intent is to get people into treatment. You're not looking to put people into debt. You're not looking to throw people in jail. You're looking to help motivate them finally to get the treatment that they need.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons, if you're looking at the possibility, and it doesn't really happen that often, but the possibility of a fairly lengthy sentence, and you get to bargain that down by going through drug treatment and showing some responsibility, is a motivator. Even if it only saves a couple lives, I think it's worth it.
When you say you decided to do this proactive, have you seen any of the crisis getting pushed into Lakewood from, say, Tacoma?
Oh, yes. Yeah. We see there's a line of demarcation with Tacoma with respect to derelict campers and motorhomes. You know, they're 1 foot on the Tacoma side of the line. Mm-hmm. But we see open drug use and a spike in retail theft and all the things that go with it on a daily basis. It's just not as severe as it is in some other municipalities.
Yeah.
So we need to address it at home, and we're attempting to do that in what we think is a more responsible manner.
Yeah, and I think you're joining a lot of leaders who've come to the same conclusion. Not all, but some. Where do you think the disconnect is between the approach that you're offering and the folks who claim that this is the wrong move?
You know, since sometimes my counsel feels that we're in an envelope of common sense. It doesn't seem that it takes a lot to understand that enabling people to continue really destructive habits is not good for them, and it's not good for society. And on a community-wide basis, we have a giant experiment going on in the state of Washington and places like Portland and San Francisco and L.A., and we see that the other approach does not work. Hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent, and it's got worse. So do you want to continue on that same road or try something different?
Well, it would appear the Democrats in Olympia at least want to continue down that road. I don't know if there's much hope that they're going to fix what it is they did in any meaningful way, that there's, you know, a watered down version of a fix is still getting pushback from Democrats. And if they don't do something at the end of this legislative session, well, drug use and possession is legalized across the board, across the state on July 1st.
Yeah, I both on this and, you know, the pursuit bill, the feedback we get sidebar with some more moderate Democrats is that their caucus, i.e. Seattle, is dead set against undoing what they felt were reforms, which are, you know, failed efforts at social engineering.
Well, I'm glad some people are doing the right thing, and we wish you the best of luck. We were talking with Lakewood City Council member Don Anderson. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Pleasure.
Now this.
The monologue.
In Seattle yesterday, there was a committee, or really kind of a town hall of sorts, a roundtable discussion, whatever we want to call it, for the Seattle City Council. And in this case, it had everything to do with small landlords and some of the concerns that they have. Obviously, it's difficult doing business regardless of the business. It's difficult doing it in Seattle. And you don't really have many folks on the council that are on your side. But you do have Sarah Nelson. She's a council member. And she wanted to make it clear at the offset or the onset, hey, we need small landlords. If we're going to address any of the quote unquote housing issues, small landlords are vital.
And they're critical because 50% of Seattle residents are renters. And these small businesses supply a significant portion of the below market rate housing options in the city of Seattle, and including most of the large multi-bedroom units that are affordable to low-income families or students.
Now, according to this discussion, this roundtable, there's been a 14% net loss of rental properties over the course of the last 4 years in the city of Seattle. Now, that's likely the case, or some version of that number has likely happened in the community you live in. If you live in an area that has a high number of renters just because of COVID. You had policies that said people basically didn't have to pay their rent for 2 years, and that's not sustainable. So some landlords decided to just close up shop and take their rental off the market. You've got a woman who spoke, said that, this is a great quote, I don't think anyone would fault me for saying, hey, I don't want to be a landlord in Seattle anymore. She had someone, she lives in or has property in Lake City. She had someone stay and rent during the pandemic. And she told this committee that someone moved in. We thought this person was responsible, but had poor credit. We decided, okay, you know what? I'm going to give this guy a chance. I'm going to give this guy a chance. But then, unfortunately, he just completely trashed the place. Then, of course, he just stopped paying rent. But because of the rules that were put in place, rules that treated every single circumstance as if someone is just completely out of luck due to COVID, they did not take into consideration anyone who's just a purely bad tenant, or someone who's just very irresponsible, or someone who would take advantage of the policies. They treated everyone the same. They made no exceptions, which made it very difficult for this landlord to operate. She had no idea what to do. And of course, she's the person who's out. She said that she had to absorb a $120,000 loss at the end of this, and the city wasn't there to help her. And then you've got another landlord. This audio was pulled from Q13, Fox 13. She's like, hey, you guys are considering a bunch of different positions, laws, policies, including getting rid of late fees or at least capping late fees. But she said, this landlord said, it's a part of the business.
These late fees have an attachment of paying for an attorney to review the paperwork, make sure that includes everything that is legally mandated from the city and from the state to be in there, the servicing of it. If the landlord misses their mortgage or insurance payments that they are relying on the rental income for, there is a fee attached, right? So it's more of a chain and more of a process. And it's also related to the fact that this is a small business at the end of the day.
They have to pay for a whole lot of stuff associated with their business. And as another landlord pointed out, 24 laws were passed in just the last 6 years. And none of the laws benefit the landlords. Quite the opposite. It hurts the landlords because all landlords are treated, again, equally bad. All tenants are good. All landlords are bad. Kind of get the sense of a theme of oppressor versus oppressed. That's how so many people on the left view things. Oppressor versus oppressed. Slightly different context in the way that we've learned about it during the BLM movement. But the landlord is the privileged person who's got property. And then you've got the tenant who lacks privilege. And by the way, housing is a human right. And so the framing of laws, the lens in which they create law, is through a social justice sphere in which they view oppressor versus oppressed. And a lot of the oppressed are the ones who are being the oppressors and vice versa. The landlords in this scenario are the oppressed. They're getting hit with fees or caps on their fees. They're getting hit with new rules that basically say you have no right to determine who goes and lives on the property that you own personally. You can't ask people about their criminal histories. You're not supposed to judge people in any way, shape, or form. So the first come, first serve rule. First person who is legitimately qualified, they're the ones who have to get the apartment or the home. Now this.
The interview.
Scary times on our freeway, especially in King County. There's managing to be like 12 drive-by shootings so far in King County this year. That's almost one a week. We have six that happened here in March. Three just in the last week. So what exactly is going on? Joining me on the line is Washington State Trooper Rick Johnson. Welcome back to the show.
Absolutely, Jason.
What's going on? What can you tell us about at least the last three? Are they connected?
You know, we haven't found any connection between these shootings. And, you know, it's alarming to us, obviously. I mean, our job as state troopers is to keep the roadways safe. And, you know, everyone case, as you know, has kind of an anatomy of their own.
Yeah.
But right now, we haven't tied any one of these together. You know, the ones that occurred yesterday, you know, 5:20 early in the morning, and then 1, 6, 7, or 18, you know, two in one day. Our detectives, you know, continue to ask for help from the public and follow up on any leads they can get from these.
Do you get the sense that we're talking about, and I don't know if I want to say it's an intentional drive-by versus unintentional, but like, are these road rage incidents? Are these targeted shootings?
You know, we don't have anything to indicate targeting. You know, could some of them be, you know, a road rage type incident where someone feels slighted by another vehicle and unfortunately, you know, decides that they're going to use a weapon and, you know, fire at a vehicle? But the, you know, confirmation, for example, the one on 5:20, you know, I've been asked, you know, was the passenger in the Uber targeted or the Uber driver? We have no indication of that right now. And as far as the semi driver with the vehicle pulling up with no plates, mismatched color, black rims, possible black hood, you know, right now they're still in the beginning of the investigation trying to, you know, gather any other witnesses. And as you know, in King County, there's really not a time of day their vehicles on the road.
Yeah.
So, you know, even if you're driving along and see somebody speed past you around that time, it may seem something minimal, but it may be the vehicle that just shot at another vehicle. So we're just asking, you know, it's not a bother. Give us a call, email the detective that's on the press release, and we'll follow up on any and everything.
Why do you think we're seeing a whole lot of them this year?
You know, last year I think the detectives investigated, I want to say around 50. I'm not sure if that's the exact number. But I would love to know the reason. Everyone is different, it appears to be. The one with the Ford, truck traveling northbound, approaching 45th, we try to gather every detail we can to try to figure this out. That's a question that I think you and I and everyone wants to know.
Well, I mean, part of this, I'm assuming, again, is just we're seeing a surge in crime across the state. We have for a few years now. I imagine there might be a little bit of this, not to get into politics, because I know you shouldn't get into politics, but there is a law that makes it a lot easier for some of these folks to think that they can get away with these crimes because they know they won't face a chase. And, you know, if someone is involved in a drive-by shooting and a trooper does not witness it, it takes a lot to get to probable cause to be able to go ahead and pursue one of these suspects.
Well, none of the shootings that we've had, obviously, were in the area or have the even chance to determine whether to pursue or not. So that's kind of out of the question. As far as, individuals thinking they can get away with more stuff, investigate everything to the fullest.
Are you fully staffed?
As far as?
Washington State Patrol, would you say that the staffing is adequate at this point? I know that, this time last year, it was an issue.
I mean, we've added more troopers, and we have troopers that are filling in spots where we have. But, right now, from my perspective, we have, plenty of troopers. And the times these are occurring, locations, I mean, it's hard. Mm-hmm. Even if we had twice as many troopers that were allotted, it's hard to be, obviously, everywhere when these occur. And, I get that. Sometimes people come and go, well, here during this time for these HOV violators, that kind of thing. Well, sure, we'd like to double the amount of troopers. I mean, I've been doing this almost 32 years, and I mean, we would welcome more, law enforcement everywhere.
You'd also welcome anyone who knows any information about any of these incidents. You can connect with the Washington State Patrol. We've been talking with Trooper Rick Johnson. Thank you so much. Really do appreciate you coming on.
Absolutely. Jason, have a great rest of your day.
You as well. You're listening to The Jason Rantz Show. On the Chinese government influence on TikTok and the national security threat TikTok can pose to folks here in the United States, we have another story that's incredibly important, but it's happening at a place where you might not expect it. Busloads of Chinese nationals have been released into the United States. The Customs and Border Protection Agency says they've seen a 900% surge in encounters with migrants from China. What exactly is going on? Jorge Ventura from News Nation has been spending time in southern Texas, and he's got the story. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Jason. Thanks for having me on.
What are we seeing at the border?
Yeah, so right now I'm in the Rio Grande Valley border sector. It's like the cities of like McAllen, La Jolla, Edinsburg, Brownsville. Here in this sector, and I came here for a completely different story. And as soon as we arrived, we started just noticing the Chinese nationals crossing illegally into the U.S. And I've been covering the border since Biden came into office. And, I would encounter maybe a Chinese national maybe every 3 to 6 months being on the ground, but not every day. So this is, from my angle, it's been really alarming to see. When you just look at the numbers, like you mentioned, Jason, the border sector here, they're already seeing a 900% spike in Chinese national apprehensions, which is just, it's alarming. If you just look at the Southwest region, this is what kind of blew my mind. So in the Southwest region here in the border, back in February of 2022, for the entire Southwest region, only 55 Chinese nationals have been apprehended.
Wow.
That's in February of 2022. You fast forward it to February 2023, they're up to 1,300. So the numbers are insane right now. So from what we got right now from sources on the ground and actually interviewing some of these Chinese nationals using Google Translate, right now Chinese nationals are paying up to sometimes even more than $35,000 to be smuggled by Mexican cartels and human smugglers. So essentially, for the cartels, they're a very viable commodity because they're willing to pay way more, you know, triple rate than like a Central American or South American migrant is willing to pay. So they're actually not, like, when they're making this journey, especially in Mexico, they're actually, you know, they're not staying in these dangerous migrant camps. They're not like sleeping on the street. Mm-hmm. They're staying in hotels, flying through airports. So the cartel is really protecting them. So that's one thing that we're noticing. The other thing is how key the country Ecuador plays in this. So a lot of the Chinese nationals that we spoke with are flying into Ecuador. Ecuador is one of the few countries that doesn't require a travel visa from Chinese nationals. And from there, they'll make their way to Neocoli, Colombia. Mm-hmm. And from there, the smugglers will actually put these Chinese nationals on boats, get them to Panama, where the Darien Gap is, and they'll cross the Darien Gap, and then eventually to Mexico and on to the U.S. So this is something that we're learning, the amount of money these folks are willing to pay. According to the Panamanian government, they actually released some data. So in November, they had about a little bit over 300 Chinese nationals go through the Darien Gap. In December, that jumped up to around 600. And then January went over 900. So even the Panamanian government down there has seen a huge, huge spike. So when I was talking to Texas DPS and Border Patrol, they expect these numbers to continue to rise because mm-hmm. Chinese nationals, as you said, Jason, are now being released into the country with notice to appear. We actually, some of the Chinese nationals I was in communication with were crossed illegally on Sunday. And as of Tuesday, they were put on buses to New York.
Yeah.
So they're not being properly vetted before the release either.
Well, yeah. Well, I suppose we shouldn't expect that, given the fact that we don't do that for anybody else. Here's a question I have. Obviously, we know why they're coming over the borders, because it's porous and it's relatively easy to sneak across. But do we know why they're doing it right now versus last year when it was just as easy?
Yeah, so we're trying to find out. There's kind of, you know, obviously there's a language barrier.
Yeah.
What we've been hearing, some of the Chinese nationals actually show me on their phones, is what they've been telling me is that a lot of them right now are escaping China because of COVID-19 policies. Some of them were actually showing me videos like from China of Chinese citizens getting beat up. So that was pretty alarming to actually like see that in person. Mm-hmm. In the other, you know, the other role now is, you know, the Mexican cartel is capitalizing. So one thing from my end is I'm hoping to get into Mexico pretty soon and find out why they're being sent to Reynosa at the numbers that they are right now. Actually, last week, Border Patrol in a single day, they encountered and apprehended 90 Chinese nationals in a single day. So that's the most they actually ever had since 2010. And the reason why it's pretty significant for the Border Patrol is, on their end, you know, Border Patrol here is already overwhelmed. We've been embedded with them for the past 4 days. They're already overwhelmed dealing with the gotaways, the drugs coming in. Obviously, they still have to deal with the other nationalities that are coming in. They're seeing a huge spike, actually, in Colombian nationals right now in the sector as well. So when you have that, and then when you have the Chinese come in, it creates a huge language barrier. So it just extends processing times. You have to call in more agents. You have to call in Texas DPS as well. So there's putting a strain on resources there. What has been shocking, though, from just to see how quickly they've been mass released. Now, 91% of what we're seeing right now of Chinese nationals are single adults. So we're not seeing like children. We're not seeing mm-hmm. like big families. And the majority that I've encountered so far being on the ground, they are men. So that's been really kind of the interesting part. But
well, is that considered specifically alarming? You know, when we see what China is doing, is it beyond them to send in spies? We know that there's Chinese spies here now. They're working various assets. Could that be behind some of the numbers? Or are we really just legitimately talking about folks who are escaping a communist regime that neither you nor I would ever want to live in?
Well, see, that's the tough thing, right, Jason, is the language barrier. You would assume that some of these folks, you know, are connected to the CCP government, considering that we're just mass releasing. They are single adults, which is like the other odd part, right? Like you're not seeing
that's always
like
a red flag.
Go up to the border, so that's a huge, huge red flag. And what's worrying when I'm speaking to sources in Border Patrol and Texas DPS, what they're letting me know is saying they've been telling me, hey, Jorge, there's no way that we're properly vetting these folks before the release. Like it's just completely impossible. So it's a mass release on that end. was actually was kind of sad, Jason. About 2 days ago, you know, we're on the ground, and we encounter a group of 10 Chinese nationals, all men. So, you know, we run up to the group. We're trying to talk to them. In that same group, there was this pregnant Honduran woman with them, and she alerts us because she had this 2-year-old boy with her, and she alerts us. She said, hey, this boy here was abandoned by human smugglers. Like, he's not my son. So we actually encountered like an unaccompanied minor that was abandoned by a human smuggler. So that was really, you know, sad to see, and it kind of was a stark reminder just how ruthless these cartels are. They just abandoned this kid, left him with these Chinese nationals, and basically they took him over the river. And what was actually really sad, Jason, is the kid was wearing his makeshift ID with a Louisiana address, and he kept saying, this is where my dad is. And from my experience reporting on the border, the if that was really his parents, there will always most likely be in the home country. So most likely they would be in El Salvador or Nicaragua and send the kid up to the U.S. So that was a red flag that he was saying that he was in the state. So from our end, we're going to, you know, we're going to try to investigate that, maybe go to Louisiana to that address. But just another stark reminder, you know, I know, you know, you turn on the news and you might see the families come in or not, you know, right now we're speaking about Chinese.
The Jason Rantz Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle top radio host Jason Rantz. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rantz is in focus now.
Jason Rantz, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
Okay, we have another reminder for those of you who need it. And I don't know, maybe most of you kind of get it already. The Associated Press is not a news organization. They talk about the news. And sure, they do some reporting about the news, there's no doubt. But this is an organization that takes perspectives. They provide analysis that they pretend is objective news. They are not objective, not even a little bit. And you have to know that going into any Associated Press story. It doesn't mean what they're writing is wrong. It doesn't mean that all of their reporting is garbage. Some of their reporting is actually really good. But understand that institutionally, they take sides. They're to the left. And a perfect example is a story that's written by Anthony Izaguirre, or Izaguirre. Let's just call him Izzy. It's titled, DeSantis to Expand Don't Say Gay Law to All Grades. The law, of course, is not called Don't Say Gay. Don't Say Gay does not appear anywhere in the law. You are allowed to say gay. So they want you going into this story already believing a lie that was created, crafted by folks on the left in order to defeat it. It didn't work. It moved through. The left is still upset. On top of that, they have a giant target on Ron DeSantis. They know he's running for president. And they want to make sure that he's defeated early on, weakened early on. They're going to do their best to create more infighting between he and Trump. And in fairness, Trump is egging it on. DeSantis, not so much. DeSantis is mostly ignoring it. Trump is not ignoring DeSantis because he also knows that DeSantis poses a threat, a legitimate threat. So let's go through the story. It says that DeSantis is moving to forbid classroom instruction on sexual orientation and gender identity in all grades, expanding the controversial law critics call Don't Say Gay. Why do you frame it around what the critics call it? What about what it's actually called? What about that? In fact, you don't even get a sense of what it's called until far into the story. I can't even find the even name, and I remember reading it in the piece. I just don't know where it is. But they say it, Don't Say Gay. Why is this framed around the critics? You can say, here's what DeSantis is doing. Here's what one side says. Here's what the other side says. They don't do that. This is entirely framed around the negative. They say the proposal, which would not require legislative approval, is scheduled for a vote next month before the State Board of Education and has been put forward by the State Education Department. Now, that means the department did it. Now, they're appointed by the governor, sure, but it's technically not the governor pushing it. I imagine he supports it. It says the rule change would ban lessons on sexual orientation and gender identity from grades 4 to 12 unless, and this is part is kind of important, unless required by existing state standards or as part of reproductive health instruction that students can choose to take. So in other words, you can continue to teach about or discuss sexual orientation so long as it is optional. If it's part of reproductive health instruction, if it's part of the existing state standards, which, by the way, it does exist, not to the extent the Democrats want. But so long as you're able to choose to opt out, instead of being forced into it, instead of having educators push this on you, you can still continue with it. Now, spokespeople for the governor's office and the education department did not immediately return emailed requests for comment. We could not pick up the phone. We sent in an email. But the White House got involved via Corinne Jean-Pierre, who is not a fan, not of Ron DeSantis and not of the Don't Say Gay bill.
It's wrong. It's completely, utterly wrong. And we've been very crystal clear about that when it comes to the Don't Say Gay bill and other actions that this governor has taken in the state of Florida. But make no mistake, this is a part of a disturbing and dangerous trend that we're seeing across the country of legislations that are anti-LGBTQI+, anti-trans, anti-the community in a way that we have not seen it in some time.
And it's not just the LGBTQI plus community.
We're talking about students. We're talking about educators. We're talking about just individuals. And so the president has been very clear. This administration has been very clear. We will continue to fight for the dignity of Americans.
Oh, okay. Thank you, hero. So seventh paragraph in, they call it the Parental Rights in Education Act. And again, it's framed around widespread backlash nationally, with critics saying it marginalizes LGBTQ people and their presence in society. President Joe Biden called it hateful. Again, framed around the negative. And then it puts DeSantis and that position on the defense. DeSantis and other Republicans have repeatedly said the measure is reasonable and that parents, not teachers, should be broaching subjects of sexual orientation and gender identity with their kids. Critics of the law says it's language, classroom instruction, age-appropriate, and developmentally appropriate is, quote, overly broad and subject to interpretation. That according to the AP. Consequently, teachers might opt to avoid the subjects entirely for fear of being sued, they say. And by the way, it's not they say, it's the AP says. Because again, the AP is in that camp. At the end of the day, I don't care how anyone views this piece of legislation or any piece of legislation. I accept that some people will like things and other people will not. Some people will say it's just and right. Others will say it's unjust or unjust and wrong. Okay. I'm okay with that. I don't need people to agree with positions I hold. I obviously, like you, would prefer people agree with me. And you would prefer people who agree with you, but you accept that there's not always going to be agreement, and that's okay. We live in a democracy. We're not supposed to have just nonstop agreement on everything. But when you look at this particular piece of legislation, it deserves an honest characterization so that we can come up with our own decision as to whether or not we support something. But they don't want that to happen. They want to make it so that all of us hold the position they want us to hold, which in this case is to be against this bill. I find that a misuse of the public's trust because I don't think everyone realizes how deeply biased the media is, including conservative bias and conservative media bias. I don't think people realize it that much. I think people are doing a better job now of understanding that there's a difference between people who give analysis of news versus just a news program, right? Whether it's Tucker or Sean Hannity, whether it's Chris Hayes or Rachel Maddow, they provide news stories, but they talk about the news. They analyze the news. It doesn't mean they're lying, but it does mean they have a position. And they want you to see the position the way that they see it, or the issue the way that they see it. That's supposed to be different from NBC Nightly News, or 60 Minutes, or the AP. People still think that there's a difference, but there isn't. just because Tucker or Rachel or Sean or Laura or Chris, just because they put their name on a show versus the outlets that don't, doesn't mean there's a whole lot of difference as far as the fact that analysis is presented. The difference is when we're talking about the AP and the New York Times and the Washington Post, they're putting analysis up front and they're pretending it's news. They're pretending that it's objective. They're pretending that what you get out of a 60 Minutes package is true journalism. That's its brand, true journalism. We cut through all the bull and we just tell you the facts and then you get to decide. We'll ask tough questions of both sides and then you get to decide. Except that's not how they practice what they preach. It just isn't. The AP cannot be trusted unless you go in knowing that there's going to be some bias. I go into AP stories knowing there's going to be some bias. I'm not going to shun a particular outlet that provides some news coverage that is of value. Because again, you'll find valuable stuff in the New York Times. But it doesn't mean that you should just go in and assume that everything that you get is going to be valuable and fact-based. And if you tweak some of your expectations going in, number one, you'll probably get a little bit less upset and annoyed. But number two, you'll be a better consumer of news. 1-800-465-8770 for your text messages. You're listening to The Jason Rance Show.